You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko jista mong toki ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā, te rā rua te kouma ono o haratoa. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday the 26th of May. My name is Justin and I'll be with you for the next hour. Bronnie Wall is not here with us at the moment, but she will be back. But I have another producer in studio today in the form of Oscar Perez. How are you today?
Mighty fine, thank you very much.
I haven't seen you in the Wire studio for a while now, in person.
I don't think anyone has.
It's good. Does it feel good to be back?
It's nice to be able to record with a proper mic instead of the tinny little iPhone headphones I've been using, but hopefully everything sounds a little bit nicer than it has been sounding, but we've been doing our best.
We've all been doing our best, and it's what's on the show today. On the first, because coming up first, Oscar will be talking to Auckland councillor Tracy Mulholland on city councilling about rates. International Desk reports on the situation in Hong Kong. I then talk to AUT's Greg Treadwell about the purchase of staff and the media works restructuring, while Bronnie spoke to Brooke Fiafia from Auckland Action Against Poverty about the government's new income support scheme to help those who have lost their job due to COVID-19. As always, here are Ha Ofakaro. You can get in touch with us with any thoughts you have to kapatu hima. You can do so by texting us on 53951 Maurane, call us in 309-3879. Now it is time for
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95 BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
What's happening on the City Council?
Yes, as you alluded to briefly, we were blessed enough this morning to be joined by Councillor Tracy Mulholland of the Faux Ward to discuss. We kind of set off talking about the budget and talking about rates. However, it fed into kind of one of the general issues that we're experiencing or council are experiencing around those, and that is actually getting community feedback and community input. So I started by asking Tracy Mulholland around what's been going on in the emergency committees and how have they been feeding into those working groups and the budget.
For me, in terms of emergency committee, one of the things as a new councillor that I've really liked for my community, and that's what it really boils down to, is being able to have a voice for the community to bring about conversation around the impacts on the community. And what is it that the community is saying to us during this time? So it has certainly been challenging, but I believe if you look at it sensibly with transparency and fairness, it's really how is it working for others? And some of the things I did in my role and capacity locally to help out during this time. I'm a big fan of social media use anyway to engage with community and to hear what people are saying and email as well. So I have found that although you weren't able to engage fully because of the distancing, you were able to engage online, and that seems to have been a very good way for people to share their views and opinions. Mostly I found at the time, during this time, it hasn't so much been about the rating or budget issues, it's been about the concern for our people about supporting each other, and that's something I particularly have engaged with. It was a bigger picture.
And continuing along the theme of engagement, leading into the budget, we decided to discuss how people get involved in what the budget is, and what engagement around the budget looks like.
I'm asking people, please email me, please share on social media, please share with any of our councillors and the mayor. Essentially, I'm asking that people in my community and across Auckland do engage. So what's come about is, you know, that we have worked incredibly hard alongside the team to keep essential services, you know, the likes of public transport, rubbish collection, to provide help for people who are struggling to pay rates. There's the deferral. But this challenge with the budget, of course, is to support jobs, infrastructure and to recover. And I believe that we need to, and I must hear, what is the view and opinion of the residents and the ratepayers. So this is all residents, not just those who pay rates, but those who might live in a family that this environment we've been in, these unprecedented times, have caused some struggles. Or maybe they feel that we should, as a council, engage on a rating level that means that we keep jobs, that we keep infrastructure going, that the debt to revenue ratio does sit at the 270, that we keep our services. So mine is about, yeah, on the budget, yes, there's been a lot of information we've been provided with. You are right in terms of the period of time of when we go to consultation, 29th May 19 to 19 June. Now, I've just been in a meeting and on the phone following that break in between the meeting finishing, and I've just had a resident say to me, people aren't really interested in what's happening with the budget, but I think engagement is critical, and I do ask our community, look, please tell us what you think, because that influences my decision on a vote. People don't feel that they can influence change anyway, and I'm saying actually I believe they can influence me, because that's my vote is what they're saying. And I believe also that a lot of people I have heard from, so evidence-based and feedback, is that people think that we are doing a reasonable job. Now, that's not everyone, because as we all know, Auckland Council or politicians or other people are an easy target, because it's a collection of funds from people. But I sincerely believe that it's because people don't actually know exactly what we do to underpin a good civil society here in Auckland and across Aotearoa with other councils. So the sort of things that we do that people aren't aware of, I believe if they were aware, then they would probably want to engage more. And someone did say to me the other day, in fact, I was listening to a senior person talking on a Skype call, and they said that they felt that we share with them what we do, but we don't listen. And that's Auckland Council. They were talking about the bureaucracy as well as politicians. That's what I'm saying. For me, it's really critical people feed in to the budget.
Do you think that that is a concern? I've heard that concern from a lot of voices. Do you think that is a fair concern, or do you think that that is just, again, another image that people have in their head of what's going on?
So I'm just going to say this from a personal perspective at this stage, if that's okay. So I think that's critical to preface that I too have been one of those people who just think, well, you know, they seem to do this and this and this, and that's okay, and, you know, the rates aren't too bad considering, and we do get a lot of services. So I absolutely agree that you're right. A lot of people feel that way from the evidence I have seen, and I have been one of those people. But I always supported the philosophy of council. I have not supported the philosophy and the way that it has rolled out in the last, say, 20 years, where central government have got local government to do more and more and more work and pushed it onto the ratepayer. So I think we should be more engaged, definitely. But also there's this matter of, why don't people want to engage? Is it because they aren't satisfied?
And kind of the final topic that we touched upon this morning and talking about satisfaction was around the rates. Obviously, it was announced, as you heard probably on the breakfast show this morning, around the 2.5% rates deferral. I asked Tracy Mulholland to kind of further go in depth around that issue and discuss kind of some of the ins and outs and perhaps a little of the pitfalls kind of to do with that rates system.
So it wasn't actually just 2.5% rates deferral. It was talking about for those of our community who are facing challenges given the rating situation, as Auckland Council is offering a rates holiday to ratepayers, and those are the ones that are facing financial hardship because of COVID-19, and we're thinking that around about 11,000 residents, ratepayers, will take up that offer. So it is a deferral, and this is something I want to share from a fiscal perspective to our community and to our fabulous community. Please remember it is a deferral. Just like if you're facing hardship and you're getting funding from other sources, people want you to pay back, and there will be fees associated to that, and they are working, they being their staff, are working through what that is, and that's one thing that did concern me, and that's why I asked a question around that, is that that is still a payback. It is not a write-off. But I also encourage our older community, so our seniors and those that can apply for rates assistance, that they do that, because government also has support funding for that too.
And, of course, you can get in touch with your local council member. You can find their details upon the Auckland Council website. And to give feedback, you can either hit them up on social media, by phone, by that council website, and or by email as well.
Sweet. And if you have any thoughts about how local council is run, you can text us on 5395 or call us on 309-3879.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
Ko te waia, tēnei maronga, irirangi poho. You're listening to The Wire with Justin on 95BFM, and we will be back after a break. It's just past 17 minutes past noon.
Auckland Transport needs to replace two culverts on Wolverton Street between Portage Road and St George's Road in New Lynn starting early June. During the works, drivers may experience delays on Wolverton Street during peak travel periods. City-bound commuters should consider using the trains, which depart every 10 minutes during peak, or if you can, travel outside peak hours. Auckland Transport thanks you for your patience while we do this important work. For more information, head to at.govt.nz.
Galatas, ahakoa he iti he ponamu. 20 years now as Auckland's big little venue. Lord had her start there, and so did Alien Weaponry. If you weren't there to see the Foo Fighters, then you were probably there to see Cortina. Galatas has been good to you, and now it's time to give a little something back with Save Our Venues. Spare a few dollars today to help your local. Boosted Live presents Save Our Venues. Find out more at saveourvenues.co.nz.
Science, it's all around us. A rock, that's science. Sandals, that's science too. A hand telephone. You'd never know it, but that's science too.
Wow, I'm impressed, but where do we go to find out about more science?
Dear Science, join Lillian every week as she speaks to a rotating roster of boffins and brainiacs, chatting about discoveries, controversies, and general scientific wonder. Dear Science, every Wednesday Wire on 95BFM, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Where in the world is Justin Wong? It's Overseas Experience, your international news update on 95BFM.
Yes, this week we are looking into Hong Kong, where protests broke out since the start of the pandemic against China's plan to impose national security legislation. Last Friday, China submitted a proposal to its rubber stamp parliament, the National People's Congress, introducing, quote, mechanisms in order to uphold national security that will ban sedition, secession, and, quote, collaboration with foreign forces that could subvert China's rule in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is a semi-autonomous territory under China under a principle called One Country, Two Systems, meaning Hong Kong will decide Hong Kong laws with no Chinese law able to be applied there. It also means Hong Kong enjoys many liberties that China doesn't, such as freedom of press and the right to demonstrate. While Article 23 of Hong Kong's mini-constitution, the Basic Law, requires the city to enact similar national security laws as this one, it has to go through Hong Kong's legislature, the Legislative Council. An attempt to enact Article 23 by the Hong Kong government failed in 2003 after 500,000 people protested. However, this time Beijing used Article 18 of the Basic Law to include this national security legislation directly into Hong Kong's mini-constitution, therefore bypassing local scrutiny and parliamentary approval altogether. This legislation also allowed Chinese security authorities to set up offices in Hong Kong. Maggie Chan, a local representative at the National People's Congress, has said Hong Kong's judiciary should set up a special court that is only staffed by Chinese nationals to be put in charge of cases related to national security, while the police needs to have a special branch to enforce these laws. Hong Kong's sole representative in the National People's Congress's Standing Committee, Tam Yu Chung, defended Beijing's move, saying Hong Kong has failed to enact national security legislation in more than 20 years since the handover in 1997, so the move is aimed at closing a loophole when it comes to national security. This follows as the city is only 2 weeks away from the first anniversary of pro-democracy protests that broke out protesting a now-axed extradition bill. Since August last year, Beijing has been linking these protests as terrorism. However, China only started to take action on shaving Hong Kong's autonomy last month. Back in April, Luo Huining, the head of China's liaison office in Hong Kong and a hardline Communist Party loyalist, called for national security laws to be implemented to combat radical violence, foreign interference and pro-independence forces, saying Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement was a, quote, major blow to the rule of law, and many people have, quote, a weak concept of national security. It was echoed by Chief Executive Carrie Lam, who said in a separate interview that months of protests were, quote, a threat to national security. Chinese officials in Hong Kong also said that month that basic law articles that banned them from taking part in local affairs do not apply to them. These statements were followed by the arrest of at least 14 high-profile pro-democracy activists. While in May, despite months of calling for an independent investigation into police behaviour during the protests, Hong Kong's police watchdog, the IPCC, which has no investigative power, cannot summon witnesses and generally exists to review complaints already considered by the police's internal complaints office, concluded in a report that riot police acted within guidelines. Amnesty International Hong Kong's director Tan Man Kei has described the report as, quote, misleading and has no impartiality because the IPCC has no power to conduct an independent investigation. Keele University's Clifford Stott, who was on the IPCC's five-member foreign experts panel appointed to investigate police behaviour during the protests and quit only 2 months after being appointed, said the release of the report is, quote, part of a wider set of coordinated announcements designed to deliver the new truth. Just days later, public broadcaster Radio Television Hong Kong, or RTHK, suspended a 30-year satirical show after the communications watchdog issued it a warning for, quote, insulting the police in an episode in February. The government then demanded a full review of RTHK's program production and editorial processes. It also criticised the public exams body for a question in the university entrance history exam, which asks whether Japan did more good than harm to China between 1900 and 1945, saying the questions were biased and hurtful to Chinese people and demanded it to be rescinded. Later, Education Secretary Kevin Yeung said schools had a role to play in educating the community about national security.
This is more than just the school education. It's also about the education in the whole community. Because I believe every citizen also have a responsibility to make sure, to ensure the national security. In schools, of course, when the law is enacted and implemented, we will see how to explain to our students the essence of the law and also the underlying principles to them.
After the law was announced on Friday, Hong Kong's stocks plummeted, with the American Chamber of Commerce warning that the move could jeopardize business prospects and strike fear in foreign residents. The Bar Association has said there is no clarity on how mainland security agencies set up in Hong Kong will operate, and there are fears that the judiciary will be instructed to act in a particular way to, quote, prevent, stop, and punish acts endangering national security. It also sparked an outcry from pro-democracy parliamentarians, such as the Civic Party's Tanya Chan, who said Beijing's move means the end of Hong Kong's autonomy and freedoms.
Today, I think that it's the saddest day in Hong Kong history. It confirms one country, one system. Under the basic law, it's supposed to be passed, or at least it's supposed to be handled by Hong Kong legislature. However, the Chinese government can't wait, and they can't really stand the freedom and the freedoms and the rights we have in Hong Kong. So they try to take away as quick as possible.
She was echoed by her colleague Dennis Kwok.
This is the end of Hong Kong. This is the end of one country, two system. Make no mistake about it. The Hong Kong Policy Act is built on the premise that there will be a genuine one country, two system. If that is gone, then the Hong Kong Policy Act, I foresee, will be revoked or substantially revised very soon. And that means the end of Hong Kong as an international financial and business center.
Activist Joshua Wong and Glacier Kwong claims in the Washington Post that under the law, activists or legislators who have participated in international advocacy efforts could be barred from running in elections or even imprisoned, while international non-governmental organizations and other organizations, including their personnel and assets, could also be subjected to legal persecution. However, Maria Tam, the vice chair of the Basic Law Committee, dismissed these claims. Who was she talking to RTHK's Priscilla Ng?
Now, by bypassing LegCo, some critics say that this spells the end of one country, two systems. What's your take on this?
Oh, no. One country, definite. If you cannot protect one country, you're not going to have two systems. The integrity of both one country and two systems need to be safeguarded. And the resolution today is to ensure that the first part is done, so the second part could be secured. Secondly, the Article 23 of the Basic Law is written in Chapter 2, which is central and local relationship. So it is within the sphere of the central government's authority and is not an article within the sphere of high degree of autonomy.
That evening, flanked by her administration and standing in front of a banner that read, quote, full support for establishing and improving the legal system and enforcement of mechanisms for the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region to safeguard national security, Chief Executive Carrie Lam downplayed concerns over the security law.
At the end of the day, we have to ask ourselves whether for a place like Hong Kong, which is an inalienable part of the People's Republic of China, could we do without that sort of system to enhance our ability to protect national security? I think the answer must be no. And since we could not do it on our own after 23 years, then this is a time for decisive actions to be taken by the central authorities. The relationship turned very difficult once we touched on sensitive issues that have a mainland angle. And you know what I mean. So I have been trying my best, but since we could not do it, I don't think we could do it in the foreseeable future, both in the executive as well as the legislature. So I don't know whether your term is the right term of giving up. I'm not giving up, but there is now another way of ensuring that Hong Kong will have the necessary legislation and the safeguards in place for national security. Hong Kong is a free society. Hong Kong will remain to be a very free society where freedoms of expression, freedom of protest, freedom of journalism will stay, because these are the core values of Hong Kong and are very much protected by the Basic Law. So I do not expect that protests will end.
Pro-Beijing lawmakers, such as the Speaker of the Legislative Council, Andrew Leung, supported Beijing's proposals, while another, Paul Tse, said it was time for some Hong Kong people to reconsider their strategy of constantly opposing the mainland. But this proposal is also raising concerns overseas. Chris Patten, Hong Kong's last British governor before the handover in 1997, said that the Hong Kong people have been betrayed by China and the UK has a moral, economic and legal duty to stand up against China.
Well, I can tell you what it should be. Led by the United Kingdom, which signed the joint declaration with China, and it's an international treaty lodged at the UN, we should make it clear to the Chinese that this is outrageous. The Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary should make that absolutely clear. We should talk to our allies, our friends around the world, all of whom have a stake in two things. First of all, the continuance of Hong Kong as a great international city in Asia. And secondly, in whether or not China can be trusted to keep its word. Now, there are all too many examples of that not being the case. The way it's actually used, the preoccupation, which everybody rightly has, with fighting this awful epidemic, they've used that preoccupation in order to bully and harass in other areas, and one of them's in Hong Kong.
217 parliamentarians from 25 countries, including New Zealand's Simeon Brown, Simon O'Connor and Marama Davidson, has signed a statement led by Patton and former British Foreign Secretary Sir Malcolm Rifkind to protest the introduction of this national security legislation. Meanwhile, the foreign ministers of Australia, Canada and the UK have issued a statement critical of China's plan. New Zealand's Foreign Minister Winston Peters has said New Zealand is concerned with the national security legislation. US President Donald Trump has warned Beijing that Washington will react, quote, very strongly against China's attempt to gain more control, while Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen has said it will provide the people of Hong Kong with, quote, necessary assistance, as the island is sympathetic towards the protests and it has become a refuge for a number of protesters who fled the city last year. The Guardian reported on Sunday that the latest legal advice for Conservative MPs in Britain says it is wrong for officials to suggest they are bound by agreements with China to refuse a right of abode to tens of thousands of Hong Kong citizens who hold a British National Overseas Passport, known commonly as BNO. Currently, BNO passport holders have the right to visit for up to 6 months, but cannot automatically work in the UK or gain citizenship. Protests on Sunday saw demonstrators shouting slogans including, quote, Hong Kong independence is the only way out, which could become illegal under the national security legislation. However, more demonstrations are set for tomorrow as a controversial national anthem bill, which criminalises, quote, violations of the Chinese national anthem, will be read a second time in the Legislative Council.
Overseas Experience with Justin Wong, only on 95 BFM.
That was Overseas International Desk reporting on Hong Kong. And now let's hear from some New Zealand media.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
Yesterday was a big day for New Zealand media, as Stuff was bought by its CEO, Sinead Boucher, for a dollar from Australia's Nine, while MediaWorks, which owns TV3, has said it will cut 130 jobs. I spoke to AUT's head of journalism, Greg Treadwell, about this, and I first asked about his thoughts on the news.
Well, this was like a bolt out of the blue, I suppose. There was a court case recently in which NZME was arguing that it was still first in the queue and hadn't decided if it wanted to buy Stuff, and then the court actually decided that NZME, for whatever reason, had sort of lost that privileged place. And it made me wonder, well, who else is trying to buy Stuff? And there was all sorts of speculation. And then all of a sudden, it turns out to be the CEO, who's got a dollar in her pocket. And the Australian owners of Stuff are happy to sell it to her for a dollar. So the first thought was, this is extremely unusual. You know, that this isn't what we've expected out of media ownership issues over the last decades, really, have just been consolidated in more and more private ownership. Well, I guess this is private, but I'll come back to that in a sec. But in financialized ownership, you know, shareholder ownership. And so we sort of, the ownership of media companies in the private sector anyway, has been in the last few decades increasingly owned by people who aren't very interested in the product, but only in the profits. And so to keep the profits up, they've been cutting newsrooms, and I'm sure you and your listeners are aware of all this. So to have somebody like Sinead Boucher come forward and say, look, I've got a dollar in my pocket if you sell it to me, and we'll make it New Zealand-owned, and we'll even make it worker-owned, which is a sort of, you know, quite 1950s socialist idea, really. In fact, she's not ruling out the, you know, the options for other investors to come on board. So, but at the moment, the only investors she's got are her own staff, and that is just extremely unusual in today's kind of neoliberal economic climate. It's just sort of kind of weird and exciting all at once. So I think in general terms, this is very interesting news. I'm not quite sure I'm prepared to say it's great news yet, but I think it probably will be. There will come a point where we'll say this was a very smart move.
In your opinion, do you think having owned by the CEO, it's much better than Stuff being owned by NZME?
That's a wait-and-see question. Look, I'm sorry to prevaricate on that answer, but I just think, is it going to be better what Sinead's done than NZME owning it? It's almost going to be impossible to tell that. But in terms of the future of the organization, both options are complex and difficult and have implications around the public interest. But in terms of it being owned by New Zealanders, I think that's a positive thing. Yeah.
So could we see more? New Zealand media be shifting towards a management owner model in the past future? Now Stuff is doing it.
Well, I don't know if this is the beginning of something or not, and to be honest, I'm not quite prepared to sort of pick the future. But I think that this has got real potential, and would there be other people who might follow suit later? Possibly, but the staff finds itself in a particular situation where essentially its owners didn't want it and were prepared to let it go. And I think the important thing here to note is that this comes, and this is from Sinead herself, that this comes with no attached debt. So she hasn't bought a company in debt for a dollar. She's bought a company ready to go for a dollar, which is, I'm just not entirely sure that situation is going to be replicated that often. Even if it's a good model, most media organizations are, you know, working with debt and probably not so easily can get just keep that debt while they sell the news organization. So that's obviously what the staff owners from Australia have done. And yes, it's a good model in some ways, but I think we're in a wait and find out situation.
I would like to talk about MediaWorks now. They announced a restructuring yesterday that cuts 130 jobs. What do you think of the future for MediaWorks will be looking?
MediaWorks is doing what NZME did, as we went into lockdown, they cut 200 jobs. The future of MediaWorks is, TV3 itself has been up in the air for some time now. So, look, the news from MediaWorks isn't that surprising, but it's not good news. It's bad news, and it was bad news for journalism when NZME let 200 people go as well. Obviously, those aren't all journalists. I think that needs to be sort of made clear. But the number of journalism jobs in New Zealand has shrunk dramatically. Let's remember that the media industry was in crisis before COVID, and in some ways the COVID crisis has accelerated the problems that the media industry was already facing. But it's also possibly accelerated some of the solutions. So, it's not a solution for the public to get rid of 180 people out of MediaWorks, they are commercially owned organizations that make commercial decisions within the private market. The future of MediaWorks may be more secure as a company, but in terms of service to New Zealanders, I think that it will limit its opportunities to provide that service to some degree for sure. In terms of its future, if you could pick the future of media companies right now, then you'd be a lot cleverer than most people in the world, because this has been a question that's hanging in the air now for we're getting on for years and years and years and years, that the media industry's problems have seemed insoluble. But you know what? COVID may, in fact, just propel us into a new media environment. I think we use in journalism studies the term media ecosystem, and I think that's a reasonable metaphor, and that when we come through all the trouble we're in, we're going to have quite a different media ecosystem. It's not just what's happening in the private sector with MediaWorks and Stuff and NZME, but also the government's proposal to merge TVNZ and RNZ, of course, which is going to make a sort of a mega public broadcaster. And that will also shift the balance of information services in the market.
Speaking of the government, do you think now Stuff has moved to local ownership, it could influence the government to put a more bigger media bailout package for companies?
Well,
now they can claim it's locally owned.
Well, that's right. And I think that is probably going to be a little bit more encouraging for the government. But because the government understandably would be a little bit more reluctant to bail out a company that was in fact an Australian company, or but let's remember that whoever the owners are, these are New Zealand journalists working in New Zealand newsrooms providing New Zealand news for the New Zealand audiences, and I hope that that's where the government focuses its support rather than just who owns it. But your point isn't a bad one. As a locally owned organisation, the government may well be keener to support it. But let's not forget that the ownership of stuff is not really clear yet. So, and Sinead Bouch has been quite open about that. She's bought it for a dollar. She's the only current shareholder. She will be selling shares to her workers and other groups as well. So who knows who those other groups are going to be. If she requires finance to make it all viable, it may have to come from overseas. I'm not saying it will. I don't know. But she has said that currently they can pay their bills and their wages as advertising picks up again. So, she seems confident that this is a go-ahead business now. And I think that's just great news for audiences. And the government could just focus, I think, on supporting New Zealanders who need news rather than whether it's who owns the company.
I'm disappointed by the government these days. Sometimes they just need a good kick in the backside.
The Wire.
Ki te whakarongo koe ki te Wire Maurunga I Rirangi Pōhō. That was Gray Treadwell from AUT talking to me about Stuff CEO Sinead Bouch buying out the company, MediaWorks cutting 130 jobs, and how these will change our media landscape. We just got two quick texts about our earlier report on Hong Kong. The first read, regarding Hong Kong, Beijing has taken this opportunity during the pandemic to take the legs out of Hong Kong's autonomy and democracy, or at least set up the foundations to do this. While the rest of the world is concerned about the pandemic and themselves, this will be the end of their freedom. We really, really can't let this happen. What can we do to support them? Well, I suggest you can pressure your local member of parliament to take a stand on Hong Kong. While the second one is from Marlene in Whangarei. Excellent report on Hong Kong. Excellent. Wish rest of New Zealand media could reach such a high standard. Thank you very much for your kind words, Marlene. We will definitely continue to do good international news like this. And now, let's go to Bronnie.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, Marunga Irirangi Pō.
The Wire.
Yesterday morning, the government announced a new financial support for people who have lost their jobs as a result of COVID-19 on the 1st of March or later. From June 8th, those eligible will receive a 12-week period payment of $490 a week for full-time workers and $250 for part-timers. It is expected to benefit 230,000 people and cost $570 million, $1.2 billion of payment offset by $635 million of saved benefit payments. Social Development Minister Carmela Cipollone says these extraordinary times make it more difficult for people to cut costs or find a job as quickly as they otherwise would. A tourism worker and mother in Rotorua says the funding would be invaluable while she upskilled and looked after her children. Interest journalist Jeanette Trishtrubene says on Twitter that the funding is necessary to prevent a mass wave of people defaulting on their home mortgages. The Council of Trade Unions also welcomed the announcement, saying the government has shown how nimble and responsive they can be to the needs of the community. So it all sounds pretty positive, but some have noticed something very wrong with these payments, namely that they are almost double that of the main benefit. A single adult on the existing job seeker benefit receives only $250 a week, compared to $490 for those on the income relief payment, as well as pretty much being an acknowledgement by the government that the existing benefit is simply too low to live on, there are greater concerns. Auckland Action Against Poverty warns that the government is creating a two-tiered welfare system, drawing an arbitrary distinction between deserving and undeserving welfare recipients. I spoke to Brooke Fiafia, a spokesperson for the organisation, who elaborated on these concerns.
I guess our main problem is that the government's introduced a two-tiered system of welfare, so that it seems like those who they believe are more deserving of support have essentially been given that, and people who have existed on the benefit for a very long time still aren't able to access the same amount. So we've been campaigning for individualised benefits for a very long time, and
the income relief payments is essentially it. So it's disappointing and frustrating to see that the government deems this group of people more deserving in some ways of receiving extra support versus people who have always been in this space. So.
I further asked Brooke how this plays into the wider stigma around beneficiaries.
Exactly. I think it's really reflective of this rhetoric that we have in Aotearoa that people have to earn their keep, and also into the wider narrative of actually living in a capitalist system and people existing as economic units. And, you know, you have to really show people that you deserve to be looked after in some ways, where in essence, like, everybody who exists deserves to be here. And also this whole idea of commodification of basic human rights. Why is it that we have to pay for these things that we need in order to exist and that we know are essential to all of us and our well-being?
Finance Minister Grant Robertson notes the rationale for the payment comes from the fact that the pandemic and impending recession are a once-in-a-100-year event. He adds that the new income relief payment is not welfare, but a one-off payment similar to the job loss cover payment introduced during the Canterbury earthquakes or the restart package from the 2008 financial crisis. Here is Minister Grant Robertson.
We do understand how tough it is and has been for people who have experienced a sudden drop in income.
Peter Sykes, Chief Executive of Mangere East Family Services, criticised Robertson's reasoning that many people will experience, quote, a sharp drop in income, noting that this is exactly what unemployment is. He therefore named it a benefit for the middle class. People lose their jobs to forces beyond their control all the time through no fault of their own. And Brooke Fiafia from Auckland Action Against Poverty notes that we are in the middle of a crisis, but people have been living in crisis for a long time before the pandemic. She also doesn't buy the government's explanations, noting that they have shown their potential to be transformative.
I think the government has shown through in their response to COVID that it's really easy to shift things and do things really quickly when they want. You know, and I refuse to believe that the government thinks that what people are on at the moment, or what beneficiaries are receiving at the moment, is enough. They know that it's not enough, and yet they continue to perpetuate this whole ideology that, you know, people are somehow going to be okay on living with nothing. And also, they've forecasted that a lot more people will be moving into this space. And so they're saying, yeah, well, all the hundreds of thousands of people that have lost their job and who haven't had a job for a long time, kind of like, oh yeah, all good, you guys can just live in poverty.
A silver lining of this is that the government has shown it has the ability and willingness to impose individualised benefits. I asked Brooke to elaborate more on what individualised benefits means.
So at the moment, what happens is that if you are in a relationship and your partner earns the minimum wage or even just above the minimum wage, then you're not eligible to receive a benefit from the government. And so individualising benefits means that people should get their own money irrespective of what type of relationship they're in. So, you know, you're not dependent on your partner to support you. This disproportionately affects women who are in relationships where there might be violence involved. It's kind of like you can't kind of leave because you don't have any income support that you can, access.
Yeah, and how that might have been exacerbated during this time as well, as we've seen increased rates of domestic violence.
Yeah.
The income relief payment is still means tested, meaning you're only eligible if your partner earns less than $2,000 a week. However, that is still significantly higher than minimum wage. By my calculations, it comes to $50 an hour. Now compare that to the job seeker support where you and your partner can't earn more than $90 a week combined before the rate of benefit starts to reduce. Stuff News did some quick calculations to find that a household receiving this new income support could end up bringing in $1,976 a week total, compared to just $375 for a single parent on job seeker support. Auckland Action Against Poverty also notes that people under the income relief payment will not be subject to the same kinds of invasive relationship investigations by the Ministry of Social Development as those on the job seeker benefit. Writing on the spin-off, researcher Max Rashbrook has argued that this could be the hint of a shift in welfare policy towards both permanent social insurance and core benefit increases. Minister of Finance Grant Robertson did note that these kinds of social insurance, unemployment insurance schemes are commonplace around the world. The Council of Trade Unions President Richard Wagstaff points in particular to the models in Scandinavian countries. Wagstaff suggests a system akin to ACC, where a small levy is paid by workers, employers and the government, where those who lose their jobs receive 80% of their salary while they retrain or look for another job. As with other benefits, migrant workers do not qualify for these payments. Robertson was clear to emphasise that they were not changing the underlying settings of the welfare system. An Indian chef in Rotorua spoke to the New Zealand Herald about his concerns. The man had studied and worked in New Zealand since November 2018, but will be forced to return to India if he does not find a job, with his $40,000 student loan still to pay off. Brooke Fiafia from Auckland Action Against Poverty also calls for migrants to be included.
We have asked the government to access a part of the Social Security Act to ensure that migrants are looked after as well, but they haven't done that. We have seen in Portugal that they've made everybody who's there or who's waiting for residency and who are there as migrant citizens, so that everybody is able to access support during this time. And we have pushed for that as well. There's a specific fund that migrants can access at the moment, but I mean, it's still not enough.
There's also been much political upheaval within government about these payments, in particular between Labour and the Greens. In 2017, when forming the government, the Confidence and Supply Agreement between Labour and the Greens promised to overhaul the welfare system. Now, benefit payments did go up by $25 a week in March. However, this can hardly be described as an overhaul. Marama Davidson notes that Labour has not met its promise.
We've been consistently clear that this needs to happen urgently and desperately. It hasn't happened yet. Both New Zealand First and Labour need to come to the table on this.
The Greens did run into a small amount of controversy, however, by wrongly claiming that they are the only party pushing for higher benefit payments. Māori Party co-leader Debbie Ngarewa-Packer reminded the Greens that her party aims to double payments. No doubt this will continue to be a pertinent issue in this year's election.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
That was Bonnie Wild talking about the government's new financial support for people who have lost their jobs as a result of COVID-19. And we have some breaking news from you.
Just a small update. There's been another moderate, this time 5.4 magnitude earthquake struck out of Levin in the south of North Island, 20 kilometres out of Levin, as I said before, which comes in amidst a series of kind of aftershocks from yesterday's quake of 5.8 magnitude. But yeah, so there's more to come. You can find out more information on GeoNet or on RNZ or Associated News websites.
Including us.
Including us.
That was The Wire.
Kōrā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nē tī mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero me ki o mō tēnei rā. Thank you to those who talked to us today. We have Greg Treadwell, Auckland Councillor Tracy Mulholland, and Brooke Fiafia from Auckland Action Against Poverty. And thank you to my producers, Bronwyn Wild and Oscar Perez. And thank you to those who listened, texted or called into studio today. And up next, it's the 1-2-4 with Jim. I'm now playing I'm Not Getting Excited by the Bits. You are listening to 95BFM. I wish you all have a very good week. Matewa.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.